Good morning. I'm Kathleen Shea on behalf of the appellant Donna Green. I'd like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal if I could. Thank you. We are here today asking this court to reverse Ms. Green's convictions for several reasons. Unless the court directs me otherwise, I'd like to begin by addressing the trial court's erroneous denial of Ms. Green's request for an instruction on the good faith claim of title. The plain language of the theft statute provides for three different ways to commit the crime of theft and two possible defenses to theft. One of these defenses is the good faith claim of title. The statute unambiguously states, in any prosecution for theft, it shall be a sufficient defense that the property or service was appropriated openly and avowedly under a claim of title made in good faith.
You're challenging, well, let's back up. You're seeking reversal. I don't think you're challenging the forgery convictions.
Your Honor, we are.
From what I could tell.
Well, in my briefing, I'm challenging both. Yes.
Okay, so you're challenging the theft by deception conviction based on the argument you're making now. You're not challenging forgery based on the argument you're making now.
In my error analysis, when I'm talking about what the harm that occurred, I do think that practically speaking, if we are really truly looking at the result of the denial of this instruction, the problem is the error caused a difference in how the jury evaluated.
Okay, but we're limited by what happened below. This was requested as to the theft by deception.
It was requested.
So I think we're going to just limit that to this. I know that you've also argued other grounds that if we agreed with could result in reversal of forgery. But this argument is limited to theft by deception. So your argument in a nutshell, as far as I can tell, is Casey's wrongly decided.
I think that, yes, the problem with Casey is that it took language from prior cases, and the language that it used was just a bit too far. And I think if this court looks at the line of cases that the state relies on, the Court of Appeals cases prior to Casey, the court in those cases is actually talking about whether or not there was enough evidence for the affirmative defense, whether the defense actually put forth the evidence they were required.
Well, that may be, but Casey is, I think, very clear that there's no logic to allowing a defense of good faith claim of title if you're charged with theft by deception, because that is inconsistent. In other words, if it's theft by deception, there is no good faith claim of title. That's what Casey is telling
us. That's the analysis under Casey.
And so you disagree with that, and you point to the statute, and then you point to older
Agger
cases. Go ahead. What does Agger say that should be helpful to us in reaching the result you want?
Well, I think the problem is that when Casey looked to Agger, it drew a distinction that is not supported by Agger. So Agger, yes, was talking about a different prong of the statute.
It was talking about embezzlement, so it's really
which is A instead of B.
Well, there's also a different element that needs to be proved, and good faith claim of title can rebut the element that needs to be proved for embezzlement.
Yes, and that's what Agger was saying.
All right.
Which is why that's problematic.
Okay, so you want us to disagree with Casey?
Yes. I think that this court needs to, given the ruling in Agger.
Okay. Can we move to the refusal to instruct on the supplemental knowledge instruction?
Yes. For both the charges of theft and forgery, for all of those counts, the jury needed to evaluate what Ms. Green knew.
Well, but this turns on your reliance on Allen
and
what the Supreme Court said in Allen. So in Allen, as I understand it, in this case, the court instructed based on the WPIC knowledge instruction.
The general culpability statute. Yes.
Well, based on the knowledge WPIC instruction.
Yes.
And Allen approved of that instruction. The court and Allen approved of that instruction. They were talking about prosecutorial misconduct in the context of should have known.
Right.
And so, said that was improper. So why did the court err in refusing to give a supplemental instruction when the WPIC has been approved by the Supreme Court?
Because while Allen approved of the general WPIC, in Allen, our Supreme Court also talked about the fact that the jury could understandably, quote-unquote, understandably misinterpret the language of that instruction, the language of the statute, which is then reflected in the
But that was in the context of prosecutorial misconduct.
Yes.
And the court didn't go on to say, and we suggest that the committee look at revising the WPIC.
It did not, but here we have a case where defense counsel is asking to clear up what he is concerned the jury may confuse in the instruction, in which Allen noted that it is possible for jurors to make that interpretation.
Be that as it may, as far as I can tell, the prosecutor did not make a should-have-known argument.
No.
In closing.
No, the prosecutor did not make that argument.
And finally, on substitution of counsel?
Yes.
What is your argument there, that the court abuses discretion?
Yes.
Why?
The court abuses discretion because when you examine the factors that are the three-part test, it's clear that here the extent of the conflict was significant. So Ms. Green addressed this with the court multiple times. She went in and said,
wasn't it three?
Three times. So she went in and
is
said
that
the
right?
first time.
I
yes, it
three.
Is. Yes, it is three. So the first time, 3 months had passed, no meeting. The second time, 5 months had passed. She had not had a meeting with her counsel. And the third time, 3 more months had passed, and no meeting had occurred with her counsel. So these months are piling up, and Ms. Green keeps informing the court she's having this problem with her counsel.
Right.
I'll reserve the rest for rebuttal.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
May it please the court, I'm Donna Wise representing the state of Washington. I want to focus on the good faith claim of title argument, but before I go there, I just wanted to dispute the factual statement that counsel just made about the defendant's statements when she was asking for new counsel. She didn't say there hadn't been any meetings. She said that the attorney didn't call her back.
Well, wasn't that the first time?
Well, I think
the first time was I haven't met him. And then I think the second time was maybe he didn't call me back.
Well, each time she complained that he didn't call back soon enough, that sometimes she had to call his supervisor to get him to call back. She didn't say she hadn't met with him at all. She just didn't like his responsiveness. Eventually, she said she was unhappy because he didn't review all the questions he was going to ask in trial with her. None of those things have to do with irreconcilable breakdown of communication.
Now, on the did not review all of the questions that were going to be asked at trial, was that the concern that she expressed the day of trial? Was this before Judge Bowman, or is this?
This was on March 20th. She said her attorney had not sat down and talked as to what the representation would be like as to what's going to be asked. And there didn't seem to be enough time. So again, she's talking about time. And that's what the court articulated at the time. Again, that was Judge Rogers,
right,
who said, it's simply you're saying you haven't had enough chance to talk to him.
Right.
And then it's raised again on June 9th, and she talks about there not being a good representation. She didn't feel good about it. Again, the issue is there a breakdown of communication that interferes with the effective representation of counsel? And that's not what happened in this case, Your Honor. This counsel clearly was aggressive and well-prepared before trial. As far as the claim of whether this court should depart from the long line of cases beginning in 1953 that says the good faith claim of title defense does not apply to theft by deception. I don't think that.
Now, what's the
1953 case was the case. Supreme Court case in Emerson, and then that was followed in 1960 by the Supreme Court in Mercy. Now, both those cases have to do with the prior larceny statute,
right.
So the issue
right.
was larceny by false pretenses, and the good faith claim of title defense was exactly the same as it is now, a statutory defense that the property was appropriated openly and avowedly. And in what
– So you're arguing that substantively the statutes weren't different.
Right. Right. That's exactly right, Your Honor. And again, the statutes were then amended, the whole code changed in 1976, but there are many Court of Appeals cases after 1976 that say under the new statute, the new organization of the statute, that same rule still applies. And the reason that those cases...
Now, what cases are you relying on other than Casey?
Ellard, 1986, Pestrin, 1986, Wellington, 1983, Hull, 1996, and Stanton, of course, and Casey. So Stanton
was, I guess, the precursor to Casey.
It is one of the cases prior to Casey. And Stanton articulates the issue as...
Should we just look at Casey, or do we have to go through this whole historical dissertation?
Well, I think it's important to look at the whole framework because every one of these cases comes to the same conclusion, and their analysis is all the same, that the element that the jury is required to find theft by deception is that the defendant obtained the property by color or aid of deception. And it's impossible for the jury to conclude that that element has been proven without rejecting a good faith claim of title defense. And so they refer to it as being logically impossible. That was the language used in Casey.
Right.
Stanton used the language, it necessarily includes an implied finding that it was not an open avowed appropriation of property. So you have to look at Casey, I think, because Casey is recent and because Casey uses, for some reason, this phrase negates an element. And I think the court tripped over itself in the way it used that language. I think it has generated confusion because that's language that the courts use in deciding what the burden of proof
right.
is on an
right.
affirmative defense,
right.
not whether a defense is applicable at all.
Like Ager and embezzlement.
Yes, yes.
Like self-defense.
Yes, exactly, Your Honor. And so I think Casey misused that language in the last paragraph of its analysis of this issue. But earlier in its analysis, it uses the same language that all the other cases say. That element is logically inconsistent with...
Element, you're talking about deception.
Obtaining by color or aid of deception, yes.
And the state has to prove that beyond a reasonable doubt.
Yes. So essentially... The state is required to disprove good faith claim of title by establishing that element of obtaining by color or aid of deception. That's what all these cases have said. That's why that defense doesn't apply, because it's logically inconsistent. It can't be present if the jury finds the element that the defendant obtained the property by color or aid of deception.
So your argument is this is not an this defense of good faith claim of title doesn't negate the element that the state has to prove for theft by deception.
That's correct. In fact, I hate to do this.
Is that too simple?
What I'll say is in this case, with this crime, the element negates the defense.
Or you could do it backwards.
Well, they are logically inconsistent.
Right.
And that's the whole point. Now, when you talk about self-defense, for example, the point is that self-defense raises an additional issue. It's
right.
not an issue that falls within the elements of the crime. So the jury has to be allowed to consider that issue. But this is not an issue that's outside the elements of theft by deception. We have to prove deception to get a conviction of theft by deception.
And what you have to prove, to use Stanton, necessarily means that good faith claim of title does not
yes,
apply.
Yes, it's logically impossible to say both that it was theft by deception and that it was an open and avowed good faith claim of title. And that's what
was your argument here as to what the deception was? Was it that she pretended to be her mother?
either pretended to be her mother or pretended that her mother was still alive. Because she...
I mean, how was it argued to the jury? What was the theory?
Well, that she was using deception by signing the checks, Donna Green, which was their... They both had the name Donna Green.
Right.
They had different middle names. Her mother signed the checks with her full name, including her middle name, probably because they had names in common. And so the a primary part of the argument was that by signing them Donna Green, the defendant was implying that it was her mother who had signed the checks and who was just not present. In fact, she testified that she told the clerks that it was her mother's account. And
well, I thought she didn't testify.
Well, perhaps maybe that was in the statement to the investigator.
Right.
That's right. It was in the statement to the investigator. But she was not assigned.
So, in other words, did the jury have to believe in order to convict her of theft by deception that when she signed her name, Donna Green, which was in fact her name, I mean, so in other words, the jury had to believe that she wasn't just signing her name as her own name.
Well, it was a forged instrument is what they had to find for purposes of forgery because they were not checks on her account. It was not her account. She didn't have authority to sign on it. Her mother was dead.
Yeah.
So some of the other evidence of deception that was present was that each month a $700 or so check came in from the Social Security Administration, and each month Ms. Green presented a check for cash in about that amount until she – so each month as the check came in, she got cash. She didn't pay any of her bills from that account. She just got cash and using the name Donna Green. She got she thought it was $19,000. It was actually about $17,000 that she got out of the account each month for over a year. Unless the court has further questions about any other issues, I'd ask the court to affirm the convictions. Thank you.
Thank you. One thing I'd like to point to is when they were arguing about the good faith claim of title instruction, defense counsel, in talking about why it was so important that it was given in this case, distinguished the facts of this case from a typical case, in that here Ms. Green was presenting to the bank, but the money that the state, the victim that the state alleged here, was in fact the Social Security Administration. And looking at it in that context, which the trial attorney encouraged the trial court to do when considering this instruction, I think that does demonstrate why, especially under these facts, it's not logically impossible for an individual to have gone to the bank and not corrected a misconception by the bank teller when presenting that check, but have simultaneously had a good faith belief that she was entitled to the money that was being given to her mother. So those are two different things. And a suggestion by the state that, you know, the statutes here were from Emerson and Mercy are the same, they're simply not.
I mean, why aren't they? Could you address that?
Well, because the statutes at issue in Emerson and Mercy were in two separate sections. They didn't have identical language to the one we're looking at now. And I think one of the biggest problems the state has here is the plain language. In order to adopt the state's argument, we'd have to throw out principles of statutory interpretation. I mean, that is not how this court looks to determine the legislature's intent. So we have the plain meaning here. When you look at that plain language is different than the language that was in Emerson and Mercy back in, you know, the 50s and then 1960. So that is a distinction here. I also think it is misleading. The state can rely on Stanton and Casey for the way that this is discussed, the way the statute is discussed in terms of not being an affirmative defense. But all of the other cases that the state relies on are very clear about the fact that it is inconsistent with patent deception. So the courts are repeatedly talking about in Wellington, Pestrin, Ellert, that nothing about Wellington's deceptive means of operation suggests a claim of ownership made in good faith. where the theft is brought about by patently deceptive means, this is Pestrin and Ellard and Hull, the defense is unavailable. So the court keeps looking back to say where it's patently deceptive. That's not in the statute. That is the Court of Appeals repeatedly indicating that they are looking at the strength of the evidence to determine whether or not this affirmative defense should be given, not determining that it shouldn't be given as a matter of law.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Next case is State versus Johnson.